Welcome to the GAP CLDF PBC podcast series. My name is Andrea Gossard, your host for today. We are glad to have you join us for our sixth episode in what we hope will be another enlightening episode associated with the care of patients with PBC. In today's episode, we will dive into the challenges of identifying progression rates in PBC, the need for management strategies, and implications of not being able to differentiate between patients who progress slowly and those who progress more rapidly. Joining me today is a fellow GAP member, Anne Moore, and we're very happy to have you joining us here today. She is an expert in the field and will help us with this podcast today. Welcome, Anne.
Gosh, I'm so happy to be here, and I'm just sort of honored to share the platform with you, who I consider like the APP expert in the world of cholestatic liver disease. So thanks for having me, and I expect to learn right along with the audience today. So.
Very good. Well, thank you for those kind words. Together, we hope to provide a comprehensive understanding of the challenges in predicting PBC progression rates, the clinical significance of aggressive disease forms, and the critical role of risk stratification and tailored treatment plans in managing the disease effectively. So let's get started, Anne.
So I hope you can keep me on track with this.
I will do my best.
All right. I'll let you kick it off.
Okay. So first off, let's talk a little bit about that patient newly diagnosed with primary biliary cholangitis. What do you counsel the patient with respect to the natural history of the disease? And please go ahead and factor in treatment options as you're talking about that natural history. But patients who come in saying, I read I may need a liver transplant in 5 to 7 years. What do you tell them?
Right. I feel like the natural history is variable and we maybe don't understand a lot about it. I sort of did this deep dive because I knew I was going to be sitting across the table from you. And I wanted to learn more about, even though I've lived the history of primary biliary cholangitis, like what has it looked like across time since before we had a treatment, before we had first line therapy? And I was sort of shocked at the statistics, which really pointed like early on without treatment, in the absence of treatment, we just saw this extensive fibrosis developing rapidly within 2 years, actually. And after 4 years, the probability of remaining in early disease was like 29%, so not great. Cirrhosis was diagnosed in 50% of the patients who initially only had interphase hepatitis, and those patients were biopsied, right? So back in the day when we were biopsying PBC patients, right? But I feel like maybe this was a skewed like group of patients, and probably a lot of them actually, we did used to call this primary biliary cirrhosis, right? And so much of this population probably presented with cirrhosis, I'm thinking, or later stage disease, even with the biopsy. And I don't think that was teased out. They just wanted the wow factor of this disease progresses rapidly and people are going to end up with transplant or death. And there was no treatment at that point, right? So I think when URSA was approved in the mid-1990s, that sort of changed. And the long-term observational studies that have been done since then have showed slower progression of disease. Is that kind of what you're finding in your,
yeah,
in your clinic?
That's something similar to what I've seen as well. You know, when I think back, I first started working with PBC not long after URSA deoxycholic acid was FDA approved for the condition. And I think about in those early years, the number of patients that we were referring to liver transplant versus later years when now we have a therapy that works for some. And we know it doesn't work for all. And thankfully, there are other agents that are now available as adjunct therapy. But it definitely has changed the trajectory some.
So to get back to your question of how I would approach that patient, I think reassurance is the key here. Mm-hmm. Because I think we have the ability to never see another liver transplant for PBC if we manage these patients optimally at this point. Well, never say never, but I think now more than ever, we have the chance to really be aggressive with our management, really pay attention to targets in terms of the ALKFOS and the bilirubin, really look at when to add second-line therapy and do it rather than just thinking about it. And in the end, make a difference for that young patient who's looking at a lifetime of PBC with the end goal of preventing transplant or obviously death. So I think now more than ever, we can do it. And we just need to bring awareness to the fact that there's treatment options for second line therapy. And I think we need to help people because just like typical of, you know, the hepatology world, we kind of shoot ourselves in the foot with these kind of like vague targets in terms of what does response to treatment. And I really, you know, there's aggressive disease. And we used to see that when we biopsied people, you could tell sort of if a patient was going to progress, if they had lymphoplasmacytic interface hepatitis on their biopsy, regardless of the fibrosis stage, that was a bad sign, as was ductopenia in a non-cirrhotic patient. Like if you had either one of those things, you knew you were going to have trouble with that patient. And that was before we had second-line therapy, that we were doing biopsies to prove that somebody had PBC. And so we've gotten away from biopsying people because you can diagnose the disease with just AMA and an elevated ALKFOS, right? So great, no, rarely a liver biopsy, only if you have a question. So now we miss out on that group, but they're easy to identify because they're the ones you start on URSO and their ALKFOS does nothing and they're jaundiced, and, but they don't look cirrhotic on imaging. Like, so they're, because there are no bile ducts, like they're dropping out, right? Yeah. So I think we can do a better job of identifying the patients who have potential for progression, but we still need to pay attention to the targets of treatment. And, you know, we got into the 1.67, less than 1.67 times the upper limit of normals because that was the clinical trial targets, right?
Right.
But intuitively, I feel like normal is normal for ALKFOS for most of my patients. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you're going to look at that patient and risk stratify on an individual basis. Is this a young patient who maybe by FibroScan has early fibrosis and you know they're going to have a lifetime of disease? I'm going to aggressively manage that patient and hopefully get that ALKFOS down to truly normal level. Mm-hmm. And then we have the argument, normal, what's normal? You know, so most of the upper limit of normal labs is around 120, right? But if, you know, you and I are sitting here, I'm assuming neither one of us has liver disease. If we looked at our alkaline phosphatase, it would likely be less than 100. So isn't that normal? And wouldn't, if you had the disease, want your ALKFOS to be normal?
Yeah.
Right. I mean,
absolutely.
That's kind of how I approach patients, and that's what I talk to them about. But then there's the flip side of that. When you have a newly diagnosed female or somebody who's been in your practice for a long time, who is on therapy, first-line therapy, they have no fibrosis evident by whatever non-invasive test you're using, FibroScan, ELF, MRE, whatever the flavor of the day is that you have available. And you know, they're 75 years old, they don't have fibrosis, and their ALKFOS is sitting right around 190. Like, what do you do with that patient? Like, I think that's a different conversation. Like, and the patient may say, I want my ALKFOS to be normal. And I'd be like, okay, let's see about second line therapy. But they may be like, I don't want to add another pill. Like, so, I mean, it's all about looking at the individual patient and making a clinical decision based on how they present. Like, that's kind of how I see things.
Thank you. So when you think about sort of risk stratification, if you look at sort of your initial assessment of a patient newly diagnosed with PBC, what are the variables you want to obtain at, or the tests that you want to obtain at baseline, then with subsequent testing to help determine sort of that rate of progression?
Okay. So, I mean, I have a lot of non-invasive testing available to me, but I like to look at this from the community perspective as well, because not everyone has access to FibroScan. Not everyone has access to MRE. Like, I don't, because insurance won't pay for it. In clinical trials, yes. Outside of clinical trials, no, in Arizona, unless you have, you can sneak it in sometimes, but not always available. But some providers in the, you know, rural areas really have nothing but an ultrasound. And I tell them, like, you can look at that patient and make a good guesstimate of where they're at with an ultrasound, a CBC, and a CMP. Like, look at the true liver function. Is it normal? Look at the platelet count. Where is it sitting? And then with the ultrasound, you're going to look for signs of portal hypertension, obviously the surface of the liver. Like, you can find out a lot with just that amount. So I'm always going to get that. I'm going to do a whole panel, a liver disease workup, for looking for other things, because liver disease never comes alone these days, it seems like.
Right.
And the most common liver disease that we see in this day and age, I'm sure Minnesota is no different than Arizona, is MASH,
yes.
Right? So hello, fatty liver.
Right.
And this is the demographic, you know, women, and well, here we are. So looking for that, but also recognizing that autoimmune disease tends to come along with other autoimmune diseases. So I want to make sure that they don't look like they have an autoimmune component, which, by the way, I feel like can only be diagnosed with a liver biopsy, because many of our patients have, in addition to a positive AMA, they'll have a positive smooth muscle and an ANA, and it doesn't mean they have autoimmune hepatitis, so have to be a little careful there, I think. So I get that initial workup, and if there's nothing else, we have access to FibroScan. Mm-hmm. A FibroScan kPa of 9.6 suggests to me that there is risk for progression, and I'm going to be super concerned about that patient. Let's see. I don't have MRE. If I'm concerned, if I have discordant results from what I'm seeing, the clinical picture and the FibroScan, I'll add an ELF. Mm-hmm. And I think, 9.8 is kind of that cutoff for risk for advanced fibrosis, and under that 7.7 range, I feel pretty comfortable. But a lot of times we start throwing nits at the patient, and we get like results that are all over the place. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I feel like it confuses the picture more. But I think that's where serial monitoring of whatever your nit of the day is important, because it can help you trust that the tests you're doing is accurate, and then it can help you as you treat the patient to make sure they're not progressing. Is that?
Yes, completely agree. So I think about the times where you do have discordant results. Maybe you have a FibroScan score that's higher than what the imaging study would have suggested, or if you are doing a different kind of NET assessment and then suddenly you're having to explain to the patient why there's discordance, which is sometimes very challenging. So when you think about that and you kind of are considering your key variables for ongoing sort of monitoring for progression, what would you say are the most important variables to include? You'd mentioned a FibroScan and that elastography or that stiffness score, as well as alkaline phosphatase, maybe bilirubin levels. What do you make sure you have on every panel for your follow-up testing?
Well, I'm always looking for liver function, and I always, I'm amazed that the PCPs in our area do not order CBCs, and I just feel like I have a real desire to know what that platelet count is. Every time I get a CMP, it's always attached to a CBC, right?
So, sure.
And then I'll check INR to make sure that there's no coagulopathy in a patient that I'm wondering, especially if you have discordant results, sometimes that INR is helpful, sometimes it's not.
Yeah.
But just the whole the true liver function panel. I think there's a couple of prognostic scores that after a patient has been on therapy for a year that you could look at, and I'm going to blank on what they are, but let me see. I think it's, the GLOBE PVC score,
sure,
and
yeah,
the UK,
yeah,
PVC
the
score,
criteria,
which are,
yeah,
risk prognostic, valuable tools. Sometimes the patients want to know, what's my life going to look like?
Sure.
So with the GLOBE, it's if you have, I believe it's a level of 0.3, mm-hmm, that's you likely are going to have, you have, are at risk for progression. With the UK score, it's after a year on treatment, it predicts risk of transplant or death at 5, 10, and 15 years. Mm-hmm. And I think I like that score when a patient, I don't typically run it in clinic because I'm looking at the patient.
Sure.
But patients sometimes really hang on to that. And if I show hey, look, 15 years, it looks great for you because we've hit your alkaline phosphatase target. We've hit you're at your bilirubin target. And again, my targets tend to be aggressively normal. That's where I want my patients. But I feel like that's backed up by the global PPC study group data, which does suggest that normal is normal for alkaline phosphatase. And it does show that 0.6 times the upper limit of normal for bilirubin is where you want to be to really predict long-term outcomes in these patients.
So let's consider the patient that you're monitoring them over time. You're seeing that trajectory that you're not really liking. At what point do you think about adding adjunct therapy?
So, I mean, the guidance suggests that we look at a year, right? And if you're not at target for your ALK-FOS or your bilirubin, you consider second-line therapy at that point. But I think more recent data suggests that you see the benefit of first-line therapy between 6 and 9 months. Mm-hmm. And so what I typically do in my clinic is I believe in labs because I want to monitor the patient, especially through that first year after diagnosis. Mm-hmm. I think it's important because you're motivating them, you're reassuring them. And so I'm doing labs I don't do it at the beginning and then do it at 6 months and a year. So I typically do a month on treatment because they like to see what's happening, not necessarily that I need to know. 3 months, 6 months. If there's a plateau in ALK-FOS at any point or we're not moving, I'm thinking about different therapy for that patient or second-line therapy. So that's kind of where I'm at. Will you get it from insurance? Sometimes. Mm-hmm. If you can show. You can't do it with one lab result. That's another reason for my additional laboratory studies is if I know I'm likely to, if someone comes in with an ALK-FOS of 600, it would be a remarkable patient that would really normalize that ALK-FOS in the first year. They'd have to be very responsive. I feel like the higher the ALK-FOS level, I can't 100% say that that correlates with non-response or not adequate response to URSO, but I feel like sometimes it does. And so I keep an eye on those patients. I just feel like they may have worse, and there's no data attached to this that I'm aware of. It's just my clinical experience with managing these patients. I just feel like they may have a worse outcome if I'm not on top of what's going on with their labs. Yeah.
So kind of turning lastly to outcomes and how these patients may progress over time, thoughts on sort of the economic challenges associated with, advanced stage disease, progression to liver transplant, access to transplant for patients, any comments about sort of what you see as important issues associated with this?
Well, I feel like, our goal is to prevent progression and therefore prevent transplant. Mm-hmm. And a lifetime of first and second line therapy is not going to be as expensive as a liver transplant is, right? Yeah. And you're dealing with a patient's life. Transplant may not be available for everyone. People who live in the rural areas in the United States mm-hmm. don't have ready access. I feel like they're at a disadvantage already. They can't just uproot everything and go to, relocate to be by a transplant center a lot of times. So, my goal is to prevent that from happening. If someone comes in late or doesn't respond and we end up there, I think it's a viable option. And I can tell this story. The first the second transplant patient in my program in 1983 was a woman with primary biliary cirrhosis at that time. Cholangitis now is before treatment. She was in her mid-30s, and she's still my patient today.
Wow.
Transplant is wonderful, and it works for these people, but we're at the point now where we have good therapy that can really make a difference and prevent that from happening.
Wonderful. And on that note, we'll wrap up today's podcast. Thank you so much, Anne, for joining us today. It was wonderful having you here and having you share your insights on PBC.
Always happy to talk about PBC and great to be here. Thanks.
Thank you.